This piece was brought to you by White Oak Pastures. WhiteOakPastures.com.
HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Health.
Heritage Radio Network was a proud media sponsor for Plantarama 2015, an annual one-day trade show, symposium, and jobs fair featuring New York, Long Island, New Jersey, and Connecticut green industry companies promoting plants, products, and services to horticultural professionals in the New York City tri-state region. Plantarama is produced annually by Metro Hort Group and Brooklyn Botanic Garden. We were lucky enough to record the symposium speakers at the event, and we're proud to share them with you. In this recording, you'll hear from Doug Tallamy, whose symposium topic was Creating Living Landscapes. In this recording, you'll hear from Ruth Clausen, whose symposium topic was Essential Native Perennials.
So next up we have Ruth Clausen, who's also a hugely successful and influential editor of Country Living Gardener magazine and also author of books such as 50 Beautiful Deer-Resistant Plants and co-author of tomes and compendia such as Perennials for American Gardens and now the recently published Essential Perennials. Ruth's books catalog thousands of plants with a focus on the best choices for Eastern gardens. So please welcome Ruth Clausen.
That's on too. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, and good afternoon. I very much want to thank Brooklyn Botanic Garden and Metro Hort for inviting me here today. I have to tell you, I was actually present at the very first Metro Hort 19 years ago and several ones in between. But anyway, it is a real pleasure to be here, and I'm very, very happy to see younger people. That's very important. There are a lot of us that are getting a little long in the tooth, and it's good to see young people coming along, and I would certainly encourage you. It is a fabulous field of career to be in, and having been in it for well nigh 60 years, I have to say I have a lot of giving back to do. So please, those of you particularly who are starting out, don't get discouraged. You probably won't make $10 million, but so what? We've survived all this time. But I would say to you, there are a lot of different fields within the horticulture field, whether it be writing or designing or breeding or working with wholesalers or getting your hands dirty all the time and actually doing hands-on work. There are so many things to do, including teaching children about nature and about gardening, and all of these wonderful things that are available. And I would say to you, if you have a hard time finding a job, there are plenty out there. The gardeners and the wholesalers and the breeders and all of these people, the universities, the schools, everybody needs you and feel needed. So go look for something that will fit your niche and fit your life. You will see here, I'm talking today about native perennials in particular, to follow along from Doug. And I must say that when I was thinking about this, natives are very important to me. I was born and raised in Great Britain, and many of the plants that were in my grandmother's and my mother's ornamental gardens were actually American natives, unbeknownst to me at age 3 or 4 or 5. And did I care? No, I didn't care. So many of the things that are very special to me, and when I find a native plant that I've known my entire life as an ornamental, I cannot tell you what a jolt it gives me. I mean, I'm levitating all day. It's very exciting to see things in their natural habitat and then to bring them into your own garden and to be able to add to the living legacy, as Doug has mentioned. It's very important, and it's very heartwarming to be able to do that. So I would say, what is better than a beautiful garden? One that provides food, water, and cover for insects and fauna. So I'm thinking about, and I would like you to think about, if you would mind, a number of problems in terms of garden types that many of us face. There are small gardens. A lot of people have, particularly urban gardens, are quite small and limited in space. We're looking for controlling erosion in some places. We're looking for rain gardens. People are developing rain gardens now that will control the fast flow of water runoff from impermeable surfaces such as parking lots and places like that. We're looking at rock ledge gardens, particularly in this part of the world where you see, I used to live in Thornwood, New York, which is just beyond White Plains, north of White Plains, and we were right on the edge of a ravine that went down to a stream that flowed into the Kensico Reservoir, where many of you get your water. It was extremely rocky. Also, of course, woodlands, which are always wonderful. Meadows, Doug mentioned meadows, and I don't mean like a little patch of 3x5. That doesn't make a meadow. It needs space for that. And then, of course, the traditional garden borders, beds and borders, and containers as well, of course, which are also popular these days. And we're looking at plants really that are beneficial to wildlife of all sorts to provide cover, for example. We might be looking for insects and foliage and hummingbees and things like hummingbirds and so forth that will attract birds and provide nectar and pollen, caterpillar food, berries later on for wildlife. And so we're not limited by any manner of means, but I would like you to bear these things in mind as we look at the pictures that I have brought for you. I must say that what is essential to me may not be essential to you. I mean, how do you use that word? I tend to be, those of you that have known me for a long time know that I'm quite self-opinionated. I have things that I like a lot and other things that I think are rubbish. But you each will have your own favorite things. I would also say that at the beginning that the book Essential Perennials that was co-authored by Tom Christopher, who is here today, is not a new edition of Perennials for American Gardens that was co-authored with Nikki Ekstrom, the late Nikki Ekstrom, regrettably, back in 1989. It is a standalone book built on the experience and so forth that I had with Perennials for American Gardens, which is quite different from saying that it is a new edition, which is not quite true. Anyway, let's take a look at some of these plants, and we'll see what you think. And maybe you'll like them, and maybe you won't. I should also say that the book, Essential Perennials, was illustrated, the photographs are from Linda and Alan Dietrich, who are top-rate garden photographers, and I'm most grateful for their work and for their friendship. And the photographs that you're going to see here are not from the book, and they're not Alan's, they're mine. So with that, don't expect the top drawer photographs, but nevertheless, here we go. We're starting early in the spring. Bloodroot, of course, we all know on the left there, can be used as a ground cover. It provides cover for young, small fauna, especially grown in the woods, very often as a ground cover under deciduous trees. The flower itself is fleeting, maybe 3 days, 4 days, depending on the weather. If you're looking to help out the wildlife, I would suggest that you maybe don't plant a whole lot of the double one, which is very glamorous, but nevertheless, I think it does not provide quite the same input for fauna. The foliage, of course, will still be good, and that remains good-looking until usually around the end of July, beginning of August, by which time it becomes very shabby, and you'll say, well, why did I plant that thing? But you forget that early on, now, in fact, as soon as the snow is gone, you'll see it. It'll come up through the snow. And the trillium, of course, on the right here, again, it provides early pollen, and it's also good for rock ledge gardens. It will tolerate being with very, very thin soil, and also can be act as a ground cover. It also is very good deer food if you're looking to feed deer. Personally, I have a book out called 50 Beautiful Deer-Resistant Plants, and believe me, it is not included. But anyway, it's really devastating to have something that's very special and just find it devoured. Aquilegia or columbine, this is our native canadensis on the left there. This one on the right is a fairly new cultivar, a dwarf one called Little Lanterns, that you might like, particularly if you have a You could even put it in a trough, for example, or a container of some sort. But again, they will also tolerate rock ledges, and they attract hummingbirds as the season goes on, as the hummingbirds come around. Wild gingers, we tend to have probably several acres or so of the European ginger, which is not, it is evergreen. However, so is that one on the left, which is Hexastylus, called Beaver Creek. It is a particular cultivar. Hexastylus is usually the genus that they put the evergreen ones into, and the deciduous ones stay in the genus Acerum. So don't get confused and upset about that. Both provide cover for wildlife. The Canadensia on the right-hand side, that is actually deciduous, as I'm sure many of you know and have grown. It's pollinated by beetles and flies and thrips, and it becomes it's very good to go under early deciduous plants such as Virginia bluebells. You might mix it with it so that you have some green foliage there later on in the season. And here we have what's now known as Maianthemum racemosum, or the false Solomon seal on the left. We used to know it as Smilacina, and some of you probably still think of it in those terms. It is good for wintering birds. It provides berries later on in the season. And also you can grow it very nicely in sort of semi-shady spots on the edge of woods or on the edge of rocks, as you have there. You might, it looks very, very handsome, backed by some nice native rocks. Plant plenty of it, and as Doug said, most of these things, plant as much as you can. Don't just isolate a single plant. On the right is Pelargonium, that is Solomon's seal. There are quite a number of different ones around, both native and non-native. There's a new hybrid called Prince Charming. Now, that's one that you might look for. It is relatively dwarf. It's a cross between with Pelargonium humuli, which is about 9 or 10 inches tall. It's quite small, and it would be fit into very well into some smaller spots, maybe. The new garden that I'm building down here in Maryland now, where I'm living, has a permeable backyard that we've laid with bluestone. And so between that, we've got probably 8 or 10 inches depth worth of gravel, because the soil is very clayey underneath. And this will allow the water to go through. But in those gravel cracks, I'm planting all sorts of things, and I might very well be tempted to, in the shade of a native beech that we have, maybe to plant this humuli or Prince Charming, which is quite low and I think would look pretty nice under the big beech tree. Also, you'll get fall color, yellow fall color, with the Solomon's seal. This is at Mount Cuba, and you can see this is the woodland border. It's maybe, you can see over to the left, we've got Christmas fern, and then we've got May apples here, Chiarella or foam flower, and then blue phlox in the foreground there. And as you go through, you'll see, we'll look at some of them. Here's the Christmas fern close up. That would be, the previous one would be an example, really, of a layered garden. I'm thinking that the perennials, particularly the ground covers, are almost the sort of lowest level that will then morph into Doug's layers, particularly more with woodies and things like that. You don't want to leave the ground completely vacant. But anyway, Christmas fern, which is a really nice fern because it's evergreen. And then you have, in the early spring, you'll find that actually it does produce, the new fronds are covered with sort of a fuzzy substance or hairy substance that actually is used for birds to use for their nests, which is kind of nice. It's just a different approach. And this particular garden was in Ridgefield, Connecticut, and the people was in an area where there were a lot of deer and stuff like that. This was replaced a stretch of lawn in the front of their garden. And they put a semicircular driveway, put in some birch trees and some ferns, and I would be thrilled to be able to tell you that the hardy geranium over there is a native, but it's not. But it could very well be. And they had a very nice setting that the deer completely left alone and gave them some privacy. So they covered, you know, and took care of a bunch of problems all in one go, which was very nice. And the Chiarella that we just looked at before, here we have on the top left is Chiarella cordifolia. And then down below there, this one here, you can see is it's a nativar, if you will, which would be a cultivar of a native plant. It's a term that is coined quite regularly now. But look at this marking here, where up here you don't have any of that. This has been is a new selection, so to speak. This one on the right you will not see probably. It's one called Snow Flicker. And it was bred sort of for fun by a friend of mine in Pennsylvania, and he was doing some fooling around with all sorts of crosses and stuff and came up with this, what I think is really rather extraordinary. Look at, you can see this here, which mimics down here. But anyway, unfortunately, it was not very resilient and croaked. So what can I tell you? I don't know if he still has plants, but I was thrilled to have it. I just thought it was so pretty because I used the individual leaves for flower arranging. And I must say, for the Chiarella, that is such a hardy plant. I think it's here at Brooklyn Botanic that they have a ground cover under the shade of white pines, which is a very tough environment, very dry and so forth and acid, and it does just fine. So it doesn't build up that fast, but nevertheless, it's certainly worth working on. And of course, its close relative, Heuchera. Heuchera's tons and tons of breeding work done, and Heuchera's and Chiarella's and the intergeneric hybrid called Heucherella, ex Heucherella, correctly. So there's all this breeding work being done. This is the straight species on the left there, Heuchera americana. This was in March. It just comes through a bad winter. You can see it doesn't look too great, but nevertheless, it's still looking quite good. This is what is known as Dale's variety, which was one of the earliest of the new selections to be put on the market. And you'll find that you'll see plants that are labeled as Dale's variety, or you might see somewhere something called Dale's strain. And you would say, well, that must be a misprint. No, indeed, the Dale's variety is should be correctly propagated vegetatively. Dale's strain, on the other hand, is seed sown. And so you'll get a lot of variation in that. A similar thing with Rudbeckia goldsturm that we'll see later on. You'll see the seed strain, which is much more irregular in terms of height and so on and so forth, versus the vegetatively propagated goldsturm that is just flat and boring, in my effect. But you'll see it looks like a bunch of plastic rolled out. But nevertheless, you know, some people like that. Not me, but what can I tell you? Okay, so let's look at a few more of these, and you'll see some of the work that has been done for the Heuchera hybrids. Key lime pie up the top left there, and then obsidian. And then this one over on the right, actually, this was in my backyard. It was taken in November. And this, not this last November, November before. This is a release that came through Proven Winners. It's called Dolce Blackcurrant. In England, it's called Blackberry Jam. But anyway, and this here, another Proven Winners release is Sweet Alyssum called Snow Princess. But this is November, and it had been looking good like this to the point where I was thinking, well, maybe I'll just rip it out. But, I mean, going into November, who can fight with that? It was pretty good. And again, we had color for a long time. Been tons of breeding work done on all of these things, particularly at Mount Cuba. And Doug mentioned Mount Cuba a couple of times earlier. And they have been doing a lot of trials on these Chiarellas and Heucherellas and Heucheras. And this kind of work that is done, and that's another outlet sometimes for students going into the business who perhaps are interested in that type of thing, to actually conduct trials and then report on them back to the industry and so on and so forth. You know, we think of ourselves, I think, very often as being, oh, just gardeners, that sort of feeling. We're part of an enormous green industry, and there's plenty of room for everybody. So don't be nervous about it. Our native Pachysandra, You know that the Japanese pachysandra, acre after acre after acre. Why? Because it's easy and it's always green. Well, if I wanted something that was always green, I'd probably put concrete down and paint it green, right? I mean, so boring. It's so dull. Anyway, this is our Allegheny one, which comes into flower quite early, as you can see over here. Attracts the bees and stuff who are foraging at that time of the year. It's a great evergreen, ground cover. It is not evergreen. It's deciduous. Look at these lovely new young leaves and that pretty modeling on it. This, unfortunately, as it gets older, the modeling will go away. But nevertheless, you've got nectar coming there that's great for shade. You can put them near a damp spot if you want to. You can put it under shrubs. Put it with ferns. You've got Christmas fern here. Just put it in an ecosystem, so to speak, that will satisfy all sorts of different things for you. It's a plant that I think is undergrown, particularly in suburban gardens, for example. You could easily put that into a suburban garden in the right place, under shrubs and stuff like that, where it will cover the ground. And Zizia, or Golden Alexanders, you'll see this on the side of the road when we're coming in, say, to May, about at this point in time. One of the plants that belongs to the Apiaceae family, or the celery parsley family. It is one of the best attractants for insects, for pollinating insects. Great little plant. People might say, it's just a weed, it's just a wildflower. And I used to do a talk that I entitled Natives, Wildflowers, or Weeds. Think about it. It's all the same thing. I mean, what is your weed is my native. So this is a particular plant that attracts the caterpillars for black swallowtails. Their eggs are laid there. Pollen beetles. There is also a new variety that has variegated leaf that's called crazy quilt. If you're looking for something a little bit more, quote, sophisticated, look for crazy quilt. It's a little bit different. And we're moving along to Spigelia that so many people really enjoy, including the hummingbirds. They will just flock to this. It's a three-season plant that will grow be looking good for a fairly long time. This particular plant was shot at Rare Find Nursery. So anybody go to Rare Find Nursery near Trenton? And this, the plant here, thank you. Yeah, that's a great nursery. Anyway, this was in a container, and it looks good for a long time and always is an attention getter. Amsonia, or Blue Star, one of our natives that you don't see that often, except when it's planted en masse like this. This is Amsonia Tabernae Montana salicifolia. Salicifolia indicating willow-shaped leaves. Look at the leaves here, how long and skinny they are. And that is the normal sort of ice blue color. This is a nativar, if you will, called Blue Ice that was discovered up at White Flower Farm in Connecticut. And here is Blue Ice en masse. I mean, you can see it. It's just absolutely gorgeous. And has pollen and nectar and so forth. It has a little bit of fall color. The long-term tongued carpenter bees and the hummingbird moths all flock to it. And it's really a nice plant. It's also useful as a cut flower. It does belong to the Apocynaceae family, indicating that it has a milky sap. And if you do use it as a cut flower, take a book of matches with you and just sear the base of the stem to stop the bleeding coming out. It's really a nice plant, I must say. This is Mihania, or Meehan's mint, that a lot of people have been talking about today. I think it's terrific. I have to confess that I did not earlier today. It is not in Essential Perennials in the book. Anyway, it's a really, really nice plant. It's a mint, which tells you, okay, it's going to spread quite a bit. It's fragrant. It's a good substitute, perhaps, for a juga or for vinca minor. It will take a lot of shade. It will take dry. It is not, however, evergreen. It is deciduous. But it's really a very, very nice plant and provides lots of cover for small insects and so forth. So this would be a really nice one. You can see here up at the top, this is not a native fern, unfortunately, but nevertheless, you could back it with ferns if you wanted to. And then perhaps plant it with as a companion for Chrysogonum or Green and Gold. The species there on the left, and you can see this is one called Norman Singer form, which is a little bit different. Look at the leaves, they're a little bit more crumply. The flowers are tighter somehow. They're smaller, I think, but they give you more impact. Very nice plant. These Chrysogonum will flower in the spring, May, April, May, maybe even into June. When it gets hot, they kind of cool off, and then when the weather gets cooler again in the fall, then very often you'll get another crop of flowers. Great as a ground cover, particularly under trees and shrubs or part of a compendium of those sort of plants. Really a nice thing. Marshallia. This is something that's not grown very often, I think. Incidentally, the Chrysogonum is one of the earliest of the daisy family, or the Asteraceae, that you come into bloom. So you'll find that many of these plants that are all Native Americans are just absolutely great for attracting butterflies and wildlife. The Marshallia is a plant, again, from that same family, daisy family, although the florets are much more tubular here. It's a very good plant to put on the edge of rain gardens, not where it's really sopping wet all the time, but slightly up on a bank out of the drier side. Put it in shade, not deep shade. Part shade or sun, it'll do fine. It's good on banks. It starts very easily from seed, which is useful because it means it's less expensive to get started. Mertensia or Virginia bluebells there on the left that is beloved by many, many Americans. That one is also beloved by deer in my experience. Whether or not that matters to you, I don't know, but it certainly did to me when I was living in Westchester County. That is an ephemeral plant. It's a spring ephemeral. It comes up early and then it goes. So what are you going to put there in the meantime? If you plant the celandine poppy, which is here on the right, alongside with it or among it, you'll find that you will still have foliage and so forth later. However, this is a very generous seeder. Should I put that in a better way? It seeds about a lot. So be careful. Be careful with some of these things. You know, we tend to think we'll put a plant there and leave it there and it's not going anywhere. I've got news for you. You all know this. If it's going to take off, it's gone. So just be careful and keep an eye on it. There's no such thing as a garden that requires no care. Wild geranium, Geranium maculatum. This again is a shaded wood plant, or as a ground cover. It's not a thick ground cover. It seldom comes. This photograph on the right was taken just on the side of a road, and then there were shrubs and woods going on beyond. And I've not seen it actually as thick as this in flower all at one time. The individual flowers, I think, are pretty because they have all this beautiful venation. And this undoubtedly is part of the bloodline in some of the hardy geraniums that we see on the market now. Also has provides plenty of pollen in the early part of the year and some nectar as well. Opuntia. Those of you that are from around here will remember that the beautiful rock ledge at Wave Hill, where you see this in the springtime or late spring, just on the path going up from the greenhouses. Here you've got the rock ledge and the gravel and so forth. Remember, if you're going to put something like this, which is native, it's perfectly fine to grow it, but as a native in our part of the country. But look at this gravel mulch, which helps that surface water to run away. You do not want to be putting wood chips or something like that around the crown of that because it'll rot right out. But here you've got control from erosion. You've also got edible fruit later on. You've got drought tolerance. You've got pollen. You've got lots of things going for it. And it's always sort of a surprise plant. It's, you know, you're going along and everything's fine, you're going to visit a garden, suddenly come upon a patch of that, and it sort of gives you a little bit of a jolt, because you think, or I think anyway, of cactus of being very Western. And so to suddenly see it, I do know a lady, actually, she's passed away now, but she was living on Long Island, and she bought a bunch of new shrubs and had two or three big, very rambunctious Labradors. And so anyway, she planted this all around these new plantings of shrubs, and, you know, the dogs didn't get on it at all. They were just fine with that. They only walked on it once because that wasn't so pleasant for them. But nevertheless, there are also always uses for these things, which is kind of interesting. So anyway. This shot was taken actually on the side of the road of Route 50 going south down to Ocean City in Maryland. And I can tell you, my husband and I were driving down to Cambridge, and I stood on the brakes. When I saw that, I thought, oh my God, I've never seen anything like that. And I do tend to get a little excited sometimes. But anyway, you can see how far, look how far those coreopsis are going, way, 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 way over. This is a little more close up, of course. This is Coreopsis grandiflora, a fabulous plant. Everything is a fabulous plant as far as I'm concerned, or almost everything. But just super. I mean, isn't that wonderful? Can you imagine just going and seeing that? Anyway, sorry. I think it's spectacular. But anyway, the lots of coreopsis that are out there now. Moonbeam, that we all know from ages ago, is one of the earliest ones to come out. This is creme brulee on the right-hand side. You know, these are terrific. I find now, and I don't know if you'll agree with me, the moonbeam that they put on the market now is rotten compared to the one that it used to be when it came out first. Does anybody agree with me? It's rangy. It's not... It should have been nice and neat. Then you put it in full sun, and it makes a really nice little patch. But nowadays, it seems like it's all kind of all over the place. You've got to deadhead the thing every time you turn around. I prefer the color of creme brulee because it's a little bit more intense. And, I shall just throw that out to you. So see what you think about that. Other coreopsis that are out there, you've got lots of different ones that are coming. But you'll find that some of the new ones, or relatively new ones, that come out are mid-border plants, not the front of the border plants, as Moonbeam used to be when it came out first. Some of them are middle of the border. I don't call 18 inches to 2 feet as a front of the border edger. So look for some of these things. And, it's really interesting to see what the breeding people are producing now. Many of them come from the Pacific Northwest. Then there are some that are bred in the East as well. In my experience, and this is purely my experience, I have found that the ones from the East Coast tend to be hardier than the ones that are bred on the West Coast. Now, that may just be me. Maybe I'm just not giving them the right care. Maybe there's something wrong. But that's in my experience, and you might just bear that in mind. But certainly the height and so forth is different. You'll see the star cluster is the top left there, and then you've got full moon, the bottom left, and then this one on the right is pinwheel with these spoon-shaped ray flowers. So that's kind of fun. Okay, Asclepias, Doug was talking about milkweed at great length, and it's one of his favorite groups of plants, I think. Certainly the caterpillars and the butterflies and so on and so forth. And the seed heads are fun as well. And the seeds have that parachute on them. I'm sure you're all familiar with that. And very often those are taken off and the animals use that as a sort of a nesting mat. But anyway, ice ballet on the left, a nativar, as in a cultivar of a native plant. Incarnata again here. Tuberosa that Doug spoke about so eloquently. Really, really terrific plant. And the Asclepias actually is sometimes used as a substitute for lithrum, although I would question that. But nevertheless, some people seem to think that it works well instead of lithrum, which is the bane of everybody's existence in this part of the world. But nevertheless, it's a great plant. Here we have Echinacea. We're getting into Echinacea. This is one of the earliest ones called Magnus that was just Echinacea purpurea. And then we did have another one over here that has skipped town. I don't know quite why. Anyway, Pallida, Echinacea pallida, and Paradoxa on the right-hand side. To me, those are two of the parents whose bloodlines are in all of the Echinacea breeding that's going on, which is extensive, as you all know, I'm sure. The goldfinches are always very fond of the seed heads of these. Leave some at the end of the season if you want to deadhead, fine, to encourage more bloom, but leave some up for the of the seed heads for the goldfinches come wintertime. On the left here, we have a fairly new one called Twilight, which is part of the Big Sky series. And then on this side, we have Green Jewel that I really like a lot. And I have to tell you that when I was living in Westchester, we had, I mean, a lot of deer around. It's a big deer area. And people usually say that echinacea is not eaten by deer. I would beg to differ. However, the green ones that I was growing anyway were never touched. So again, and to go back to the coral bells, the hookeras, I must say that, again, a lot of people say, well, the deer don't go for them. However, deer have very, very poor eyesight. They have very good sense of smell, but poor eyesight. And they would go for the green hookeras, the green-leaved ones, but the dark ones would be left alone. My theory is that they couldn't see the dark-leaved ones. And I mentioned it to Dan Himes, and he said, oh, I don't know about that. I don't know about that. But I mean, he's only bred 500 of them or something, so maybe he'll work it out. But it was kind of interesting to see that. I don't like these. That's a milkshake on the... Sorry. That's milkshake on the left-hand side. And on this side is Southern Belle. These belong to the Confections group. I mean, that's all part of marketing. It's the PR and so forth, like the Big Bang series and some of these other things. This is all marketing. It has nothing to do with the correct nomenclature, but that's the section that they fall into. Monada, bee balm, one of my favorites. That fistulosa on the left-hand side, very nice in front of shrubs and stuff. Often you'll see them on the side of the road with some shrubs and things like that. You can see they're attracting insect pollinators here on this side. Also, we've got here on the left is one that was new to me until last year. It's called Monada bradburyana. And apparently it is being used in the breeding work. Off here to the right is one called Cranberry Lace that has bradburyana blood in it. You can see there's no mildew here. This, again, is at Mount Cuba. They're doing a lot of testing on this for mildew and for all sorts of different things. But look at that nice, clean foliage, and the Cranberry Lace has the same. There's not a spot of mildew on it, which is very impressive. It's probably August, maybe when I took these pictures at Mount Cuba, that's right. You could put this also, the Cranberry Lace is low to the ground. It's probably not more than 15, 18 inches, something like that, would fit into a small garden very well. The hummers come to them. You could put them in the herb garden. They're very, very nice plants, I think. Mint tea, of course, stuff like that. And they've been used in herbal gardens forever. But particularly because these ones have no mildew, that was important to me. Moving along, we're getting more into high summer now. We have anothra or evening primrose over on that side, another one that is a good pollen producer, needs to be in full sun, will take dry soil, will take a little drought if you have a problem with that, and it tolerates pollution. If you happen to be in an urban garden, you might want to consider some of this. But again, you just keep an eye on it that it doesn't get away from you, because the drier it is, you'll find the less they will spread so fast. By and large, if you put things who like to be in full sun, if you put them in shade with dry soil as opposed to in sun with plenty of moisture, you'll find that they don't spread so much. We have Gora here on the right. This is one called Star White, So White, which is a dwarf cultivar, again, that has been put on the market. And this is particularly good if you mass it, as you can see here. Again, it's drought tolerant. You can put it in containers because it's the right shape, really, and the right size to go into that. But I must tell you, I was quite excited a few years back. I was in Paris. Does that sound glamorous? I was in Paris. Anyway, we were going along, and I was in a bus or something, and going down one of the major boulevards, and there were, you know, how they have the traffic circles in the middle, and it was divided into sections almost like a parterre type of a garden with low hedges, and inside the middle part where, you know, they planted, and it was completely covered with gora, our native Gara from the prairies. And I thought, wow, if it's good enough for the Parisians, it's good enough for us. It's really nice, really nice thing. Let's go on here. Whoops-a-daisy. There we go. That's Salvia Greggii, called Glimmer, which is a fairly new one in the marketplace, again, for pollen and nectar. And then on the right here, we have a Pentstemon Husker Red that many of you probably grow. This will do well on the edge of a rain garden. I wouldn't put it in the rain garden, but right on the edge where it's a little bit on the drier side. Great for hummingbirds, and all the Pentstemons attract hummingbirds. Great in a meadow, something like that. I've had a little bit of a problem with it because although the red on the leaves is pretty persistent, how far down are you going to deadhead it? If you leave this just to look icky, then it looks untidy and so forth. But so I don't know. I never know quite where to cut it back. Down here maybe, or down here. Maybe I need to pull it lower and encourage new growth to come up from the bottom. So when you work that out, please let me know. Okay? Gelenia, or otherwise known as Portoranthus, Bowman's root is a common name for it. It used to be a wonderful stand of it in the old native plant garden at NYBG, but that has long gone, I'm afraid. This will handle wet or dry soil. You can use it for cutting. You might consider in a more formal garden putting it as a substitute for baby's breath. It has that same sort of airiness about it, which is fun. It has fall color. Particularly from the red stems and the seed heads as well. Full shade, not full deep shade, but part shade or full sun is good. Clay soil, it'll handle quite well. You've got a lot of good things going for it. And it's a very, very nice, I don't know why I like it so much, but anyway, I do. So, Helenium or sneezeweed, not because it gives you hay fever, but because the early colonists used the dried leaves instead of snuff. Moorhine Beauty on the left there, and then this is Mardi Gras, which is relatively new, but look at all those pollen. I mean, if you're a bee, come on. Aren't you going to go right for these things? Just wonderful. You can put them in borders. They're just as at home in borders as in a more informal setting. Mask them. Tons of pollen. They're just really, really good plants. So I like them, particularly in a mass or in a border with other things as well. Think now of all the asters that we've been looking at, or the aster family plants that we've got. This continent is so rich in the aster family. The depth of plants that are native in this, in this country is absolutely phenomenal. And quite honestly, the Europeans, their tongues are hanging out to see how many wonderful things we have here. And we have, even today, not appreciating it as much as we should, and developing the whole native plant system and the movement and so on and so forth. I mean, I don't want you going and chaining yourself to railings or something like that. But nevertheless, we need to push it. And I think one of the things that gardeners tend to be is sort of quiet and not very exuberant and not very out there. And we need, in the industry, we need PR people. We need people who are writers. We need all of these different fields that are wide open to all of you that are just coming on. And I would say to you, go for it, because it's a great field to be in. Anyway, I'll get off my horse in a minute. Liatris, Blazing Star. From the prairies, of course, this is Liatris spicata off on the left. This is Florestan White on the right that I like so much. People always say, oh, yes, they start to flower from the top down. Well, indeed they do. Look at these here. So you've got all these buds down here that are going to flower in the next 2 or 3 weeks. I mean, that's a long season of bloom. And, of course, the florists snap off the tops of here. They just love to have Liatris. But a nice plant. Consider replacing, if you have Lithrum, God forbid you should have planted it, but if you have it, consider replacing it with Liatris. Works quite well. So these are all things that that I can pass along to you, and I hope that they will be helpful to you. Over that side, we have Heliopsis. We have the sea holly over this side, another plant that attracts a ton of pollinating insects. Also, it produces that architectural feature of vertical and architectural structure within the garden. Don't cut it back after it's flowered. Just let it be up there. The seed heads are very popular with seed-eating birds. You've got a lot going for it. This is Yuccifolium, which is our native one. There are some that are much bluer and much more fancy, perhaps, than this, or maybe just, you'd say, more decorative. Nevertheless, I think this is terrific. And put in with other things, it just looks great. This photograph was taken at the top on the edge of Route 301 in Maryland. Okay, I consider the fact that we have so many wonderful verges and ditches and wild areas on the side of highways to be such a wonderful advantage. And I would encourage any of you, particularly any of you who are involved in politics or with political institutions, to encourage no-mow zones where you've got, you know, a lot of time. Down in Maryland, I was thrilled to see that there were tons of areas where the milkweeds had not been mown. In other areas, the milkweeds are mown, as is everything else. I mean, it's just flat. Here we have Goldsturm strain down below, Rudbeckia. Up here is Rudbeckia herda. Whoops, what did I do now? Okay. Rudbeckia herda up on the top, just growing wild right out there in all its glory. The bottom we have Goldsturm, the strain. As I said, the Goldsturm that is all vegetatively propagated tends to be very flat and very uniform, which may be what you want. That's not my taste, but that doesn't mean anything. When you have it like this, I think it looks really lovely. Another one of the Rudbeckias I love is that one on the left. That is Triloba, or the brown-eyed Susan. It's quite airy. It grows up to 4 or 5 feet, something like that. It is treated very often as a biennial or as a short-term perennial. It will seed itself. The birds will come for it for the seeds. The butterflies will come for the flowers. It's a good cut flower. I've even used it to decorate the altar in church with a great big bouquet of them, just all by themselves with a white background. They look stunning. And then we have over here Rudbeckia nitida, which is taller. Must be in the back of the bed or in, if you're putting it into a border, or, you know, a nice stand of it with other things out in the field in a meadow situation. Lobelias, Doug mentioned this before, Lobelia cardinalis over there. And then this side is Lobelia syphilitica, the great blue lobelia. And I have to show you up at the top of this picture, right there. This photograph was taken at a rest stop between here and Maryland. I cannot tell you where it is, but they had planted these native plants, the blue lobelia and the Rudbeckias, right next to each other. I mean, they must have been polluted out of their skulls. There was probably no water coming into there, and they were stunning, absolutely stunning. And I have to tell you that I was so impressed to see, I don't even know what state it was, probably, well, it could have been Delaware, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Maryland, wherever, between here and there. But to the fact that they had these plants growing there, I thought was dramatic. And they looked wonderful, and people were just walking by them. And you know, when you have places like that, they very often tend to be littered and all this stuff. And the place was really clean, and people they respond to seeing beauty like that. And jopaiweed, on the left there, you'll see just a tiny part of the new native plant garden at New York Botanical Garden with jopaiweed and the blue lobelias here. Jopaiweed over here with some of its friends, and then, go ahead, move, there we go. This is one called Gateway. No, this, excuse me, Gateway is about 5 feet, is one of the nativars. This one is Little Joe, that is about 3.5 to 4 feet, and now there's one out called Baby Joe, that is about 18 inches to 2 feet, something like that. So you've got one for whatever size your property is or whatever size you need. But look for Baby Joe because they're very similar. They can go into rain gardens. They can go into beds and borders. They can go into meadows. They can go into all sorts of different places. But certainly the wildlife will be grateful and appreciate wherever you put them. Veronica on the left, that's a hybrid called Eveline. Gives you a nice vertical accent. On the right here is what used to be known as Veronicastrum, now known as Veronica virginicum, I think. Tall, 5, 6, 7 feet, maybe even taller. Go on the edge of the woods, you can see how it's shows up against a dark background like that. A lot of these things, you know, that are tall and stately, they need a background. You can't just kind of let them hang out. They really need a background to look good. And this particular is particularly so. You see these leaves that are in whorls all the way up the stem. Again, the wildlife just flock to them, and they're really very, very nice plants. The Veronicastrum tends to like it a little bit moister. Veronicas are just ordinary type soil, full sun, nothing special to do about that, and lots of different species, of course, and cultivars, so I'm sure many of you have worked with them before. And Agastache, or hummingbird mint, that one is Blue Fortune on the left. That is a nativar of Fanniculum, Agastache Fanniculum. This one is Heat Wave on the right, and that is a cultivar of Rupestris, Agastache Rupestris. And you can see that the shape of the flower spikes are quite different. Here it's almost like pokers. Here it is much more widely spaced. Many of these have come down from the west coast, from the southwest and from Mexico, but they are usually hardy here. Not all of them. Some of them you'll find you'll need to replace every year. But certainly wonderful fragrance. Birds, butterflies, hummingbirds go crazy. Really provides a lot of interest in the garden, and certainly something that you would consider. I think most people are growing, you know, several of these at the time, but there are so many new ones coming out, and the coloring is just beautiful. Physostigia, obedient plant there on the left. I think probably most of you are aware that it tends to romp. I mean, it is a mint family after all. And it does tend to spread a lot. You would not say that it is obedient, except that's the flowers. On the right here, we have Miss Manners, which is much better behaved. There's also a pink Miss Manners, and that tends to be much more controlled. I found, too, that if you put these in part shade in dry, they don't spread nearly as much as if they're in full sun with decent irrigation and stuff like that. So that's sometimes a way to control some of the spread of these things. But again, we're talking wildlife that come to these, and deer do not come to them in my experience. The Aster divaricatus, this is the one that is one of our native white woodland asters. It was a favorite of Gertrude Jekyll, who was a garden designer at the beginning of the last century. She used to put this lollygagging over those big cabbage-shaped leaves of Virginia. That was sort of one of her signature combinations. Here we see it in the woods because it's the seeds are spread by the wind, and it just is really all over the woods in Westchester, certainly, and I would expect to out of the urban city, but it's really a nice plant, and it provides good cover late in the season. Late bloom in the end of the season, and in heavy shade. It'll take heavy shade and still bloom as nicely as that for you. Solidagos, goldenrods, I don't care what anybody says, I think they're terrific. The ones, this one over here is Solidago canadensis. Okay, do not plant this in a formal garden. Do not plant it in a bed or somewhere where it needs to be controlled. Give it 5 acres to do its stuff, okay? They used to be up at Woodbury Common in I don't know where it is, Westchester, Putnam, whatever county. Anyway, and you would go along the bridge there, and just on the, there was a big drop for off the bridge, and on the right-hand side there literally was a field that was probably 5 or 6 acres. It was enormous, and I was always so careful going around that corner, thinking that I was going to go over because I was dying to stop the car with all the people behind me to take a photograph. I mean, it was just magnificent. But what's interesting, I think, here we have Queen Anne's lace that we all know about, and it's a noxious weed for some people. It's also naturalized very nicely here. However, it is not native, which is an interesting combination. You often see those together. Here we have the sempervirens, Solidago sempervirens, or coast goldenrod. It's growing here. This is in the wild. It's growing here in pure sand, wonderful in coastal gardens, will take the salt very well. It takes very, very poor soil. Don't water it and fertilize it and put compost on it and all of those good things. Treat it really like a roadside weed, and it will thrive. You can see how robust these flower heads are. They're really wonderful. The end of the season now. This is Spiranthes, one of our native orchids, ground orchids. Spiranthes flowers late in the season, will do well in containers. It's called Spiranthes because as the flower spike comes up, it spirals, hence Spiranthes. Smells of vanilla. What could be more wonderful in early November to smell something of vanilla outdoors? Just gorgeous. If you can spare it, you can even use these as cut flowers, some of these long stems. I don't because I adore it, but you could do that if you wanted to. Give it plenty of water. Give it some shade. It does not like to be in full sun. It's great in containers, but do be sure that its roots stay moist. And late butterflies and so forth will really go for it. This is the last shot I want to show you. This is Amsonia hubrechtii. We saw Amsonia early on in the spring. This is its fall offering, so to speak. It's a wonderful plant for that time of the year, and I would say to you, go out, choose your plants carefully. I hope that this has been helpful and has given you some ideas, perhaps, but just go and do the best you can because it'll turn out wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.